Good afternoon. Let's get started. Something I'm sure you'll find pleasant is no class next week. It's spring break on campus, and although I'm sure here you have your own spring break rules, you know, what happens at Epic stays at Epic, right? Is that the motto or whatever? But I will be holding office hours, and apropos to that, I normally would have returned homework number one, which I'm currently grading, next week. But since there's no class, I think an alternative will be that I will hold office hours. And even if you don't have any particular problems, you can stop by and pick up the graded homework at one of the office hours. If there's any other alternative, I thought maybe of leaving it with the receptionist out at the entrance there or something else. Is there any other good way? Normally, there's all sorts of privacy rules they discourage, just putting a pile out there and say, sort through that and find your own. You may or may not have a problem with that, but there are some fairly strict rules. In fact, there's a rule which you're kind of in a good position because you're just past being students or just at students and just nearing parenthood. But there's apparently a rule in place that if a parent calls up and says, my son or daughter's in your class, how's he or she doing? We normally can't tell them under federal law because of privacy. Now, normally I ignore that, particularly if mom and dad are paying the tuition. I figure you're paying for it, you get to know what's going on. But at any rate, a situation there. If any of you know any other good ways to get the graded thing to you, it's not quite done yet, but certainly will be into next week. I prefer giving it to you personally, like I'm going to do with the Project 2 sheets, but if there's an alternative, which some of you know, certainly you can have a buddy pick it up or something like that. Or if there's a place you'd want me to leave it, I don't know what a good place would be short of the receptionist out at the entrance to the building here. But at any rate, what's happened is you should have gotten a Piazza message sometime today, mid-morning or a little bit later, that Project 2 had been graded and a lot of the details. The TA is fairly careful. I think he did 148 test cases. That seems crazy, but what they were is mostly just tiny things. Let's try this token, let's try that token, let's try this error, let's try that error. And what went on, most of you went pretty well. Let me skip ahead and see if we got the distribution there. But you see the distribution there, out of approximately 67 or 68 people who handed something in. And if you didn't get graded, there's a chance we may have lost something or something. Contact me or the TA. 19 got 100, and an additional 24 got into the 90s, both of which are very, very good grades. An additional 7 got into the 80s, 3 in the 70s, 2 in the 60s, 2 into the 50s, 2 into the 30s, 1 in the 20s. And this count of 7 zeros is apparently erroneous. I've seen messages since. There's nothing like showing somebody the grade of 0 to get their attention. And what happened, at least one case, the person I think did their project in Java 8 and there were some compatibility problems. And two others were partners. And I think the TA did not read the README carefully and see that so-and-so had a partner. I properly ask you if you have a partner only hand in one for fear the TA may grade the same thing twice with wasted effort. But it's incumbent upon him to see the message saying, I'm the partner of so-and-so, so whatever that person got, I also got. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if you have a problem with that scanner, is there a chance?
Yes. In fact, I've gotten a couple of people who've emailed me. Anybody who wants the project, a correct Project 2 scanner to use in Project 3, just email me. I normally don't put solutions up on the web broadly available because I may want to teach this course in future, and I hate to say I have solutions floating around. But personally, if you would want a copy, send an email to me, and I'll send you my complete solution.
I guess the reason I asked the question is because the students might. And so anybody who has
just use the late policy. Remember, the late policy is you only get charged late days if you agree they're appropriate. It, all you have to know, you're you know, like a call from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. The phone call comes in and good things happen. Well, not good things, but magic things happen. So if you decide that, in fairness, that having a working scanner or not was an impediment to getting anything on time, just in your hand and say, don't charge me late days because I had this good excuse. We had one guy who was flying in and his flight got canceled, things like that. This is a business and this is only one part of what you're doing. Profs always have the misapprehension that their course is the center of the world and everything else is unimportant. What, you dared get the flu while my project was due? How crude of you, or something like that. So in this case, you know, use your best judgment, and if it comes in a day or two late, just mark it off as the interface between projects 2 and 3. And that's the same for anybody else. I'd prefer you use your own project 2 if it's working, sort of, you broke it, you bought it sort of thing. But if you had a real problem where you just couldn't get it working, there's no reason for subsequent projects to be hampered by lack of a good scanner. We'll give you the working scanner. You've already paid your price on that, and we'll then focus on the parser due today or a week from today, and then the type checker, which I'm talking about today, and then finally the code generator. In fact, it's one of these things, I don't know how it's been going for you, but the semester's flashing by. With next week off, we only have 5 lectures left after that. So we're a good 2/3 through the class. I don't know if it feels like you learned 2/3 worth of a class or not, but that's the way it's been. So anyway, let me hand these out. What these are our detailed sheets, and he says specifically where his tests were, which ones you failed, and you're welcome, of course, if you think you worked, to try it. And if, in fact, it did work, or you have some way of explaining that he misunderstood what you were doing, email him, and we'll get it fixed. So Denzel Showers. You don't have an Aunt Patricia working at the university, do you?
No.
Oh, okay. I knew another. Ryan Smith, or Smith Ryan? Ryan Smith, probably. Wesley Samoltula. I know it wasn't too close, but yeah. Joel Thompson. Derek Thompson. Are you related?
We are not.
Nah. Oh, there's Tommy Thompson. He was well known for a while, too. Vempathy. Viernig, V-I-R-N-I-G. David Whalen. Michael White. Daniel Wilmer. Kwang Yin. Y-I-N. Daniel Yogurst. Zhao Zun. Brian Baker. Jay Begwala, Jonathan Block, Matt Borofsky, Eric Boyd. Theodore Brenner. It strikes me if you have a partner, you probably only get one sheet you'll have to share with your partner. I don't think he did duplicates, or didn't in all cases for sure. Blake Campbell. Carl Carlson. Josh Shansar. Wait, weren't your showers a bit ago?
Yeah.
Okay, you're the authorized representative. Ryan Kalipi. Clark Downham. Lorian Drager. Sam Felt. Timothy Faye Ryson. Benjamin Fleming. Brandon Frank. Dan Gerber. I had an old cat who loved your product.
Oh, yeah?
That's all he could eat. G. Ye Sheng. Timothy Gieselman. Hamad Osama. Jacob Harper. Michael Hudson. Eugene Yuan, H-Y-U-N. Isaac Stewart. Dustin Carroll with a K. Susanna Kelly. Eric Kleinberg. Stephen Lomp here. Or Lomp there, or Lomp anywhere. Corwin Lawrence. Ann Litterski. John Liu. Tim Lohr. James Makajewski. Dustin Maiden. Mason Madden, Manden. We get it. Luke Matthews. Lynn McCormick. Patrick McDonald. Andrew Maranovich. Nicholas Malik. Kirsten Moore. Back already.
Yes, thank you.
Norton Wisla Dash Blaze. Matthew Owen. Robert Owen. Are you related?
I doubt it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Tricia Pearly. Trey Pick. Elizer Posner or Posner? Catherine Pracknow. Malcolm Reed. Patrick Robichaud. Did I get it right again?
Yeah.
Cool. I'm learning. Amazing. Michael Santana. Nicholas Schober. And very last person, this is purely by accident, Emma Schultz. So let me make some comments on Project 2. Generally, people have done very well. And even if you're among those who haven't done so well, don't feel like you're doomed, particularly in fact that we still have the three project steps left. Normally, people who continue on the project and manage to get a working compiler to the point of generating code do well in the course, certainly well enough to pass. And I'm not promising any particular letter grade, but if you get a working compiler and don't totally bomb the exams, you've passed the course. And depending on how well the compiler and the components run, you get your grade. Also, I mentioned this before, but people always get worried when they see all these 100s and so on, is that there's no limit to the number of grades. That is, I don't do what they call grading on the curve, which says among 100, there may be only 15 A's. That's just irrelevant, particularly in a place like this where the employees have been picked and chosen anyway. So I'll give as many A's as I think are appropriate, and because your partner got a good grade does not hurt you in the least. In fact, it's probably better because your partner or your roommate or your colleague can perhaps help you or give you some good advice or so on. So you get the grade you earn independent of how well other people are doing. And I think that's the way it should be, particularly in a course like this where we're not doing with undergraduate students, but we're all doing with adults who have professional careers. Project 3 is due today, but again, we have seven extra days if you need them, particularly if you have office or other problems that have to intercede with your work. So what I want to do is I was talking last time about Project 4, which is really what we'll be talking about for the most part today. And actually, one of the sharp-eyed students, came up with a couple of errors that were noticed, and I'll correct those. I've already gone ahead and put on the class webpage a corrected version of the assignment. Now, the errors are fairly minor, and it's certainly not that if you looked at the assignment as it stands that you've got complete garbage. But let me bring that up and show you what's been changed. Okay. Oops. Oh, don't do this to me. Let's try it again. Okay. See, if anybody needs a copy, I think I brought some extra copies of 4. In case anybody needs them. So does anybody need or want a copy of 4? A couple there. Slide that down. Cool. And here, that fall down there needs one too. Boy, is this going to be close. I think we may have the last two consumed. I see two hands. And you got one pre-punched, aren't you lucky? Okay. So let me talk about the changes. You might, if you have something in front of you, want to make the changes. One is totally minor, it's a mere typo, and the other is a matter of me changing my mind at some point in how I laid out information. So the very minor thing, let's see if we can find it here. Is that in the paragraph where it says corresponding, where it talks about class, see, this is the corrected one. It talked about class check type, and that line should be class type checking. So it find the paragraph corresponding, and the second line, it says it should be class type checking, and that was just merely a typo. Something a little more significant that I'll talk about later today is that we're going to be talking about extra information that you add to the abstract syntax tree as you're type checking. And as you might imagine, this would be type info, but there's also a corresponding concept that goes along with type, and that's what I call kind. This normally says that when you're manipulating objects in a computer, they can be different kinds of things. By that, I mean it can be a variable, which means it's changeable, or it can be constant, which means it's not. Or it could be a method, which some people call a procedure or a function, which means it can be called for execution purposes. Or it might be something that's just a label and that's used as a placeholder. So we call these sort of things kinds. Also, you can have an array, which is different, of course, than having a single variable. Arrays have multiple values. So we have this notion of a kind of things, and most of these kinds of things have a type. So typically, when we type check, we'll determine two things, a type and a kind. Now, it was noticed that in this handout, it was different than what I have in the actual startup package that I gave you in terms of string literals. So I thought it through, and this is the sort of thing we bounce back and forth. What happened in the original handout, I talked about string as a type. And I've rethought that, and I've moved string over to a kind. And the type of string literal is character. And that sort of makes sense among the ways to organize this. You think of a string as being a conglomeration of characters. It's not quite an array because arrays can be indexed and strings can't. But what are strings composed of? And of course, they're composed of characters. So in the AST and in the updated notes and in the updated handout, we now have the fact that if something's a string, that's considered kind information and the corresponding type is character because inside the string are characters. And there are ways, for example, to assign a string to an array as a way of exposing the individual characters. You would do that, for example, if you wanted to do some application where you had to edit a string, print an error message, or whatever it might be. So it's a significant change, not overwhelming, but it's something that a very sharp-eyed individual noticed that it was one way in the code and another way in the documentation, and that shouldn't be. So that's since been fixed. So what I wanted to finish up on is first saying what it is we have to do when you're doing type checking, and then I'll actually show you how to do it. What it's going to be is something you're now becoming familiar with, I hope, and that's namely walking the abstract syntax tree. You've already walked the abstract syntax tree in Project 1, where you're getting information about identifier, the declarations and uses in terms of doing a cross-reference. You've also, when you finish up the parser project, do something with respect to unparsing. And in fact, one thing I wanted to mention in unparsing, because it's come up a couple of times, has anybody noticed that something interesting happens when you try to unparse a read node or a print node? Yeah, and let me show you what's happening and explain what's going on and perhaps suggest a couple of fixes. What's perhaps happened, and some of you may have fixed this already, some of you, if you've not gotten to the point where you're worrying about it, I'll give you a little heads up, is that if I do something like print 1, 2, this is really a convenience for the user. If you actually look at the abstract syntax tree for a print statement will have create print nodes and it'll create a list of them. And that's because in the actual definition of a language, this structure does not exist. What does exist is something that's semantically equivalent, that is, has the same meaning, but is a little more simple and a little more elegant. Namely, this is equivalent to a print of one followed by a print of two. That's fine. And the version up top is just for convenience. Oftentimes when we want to print stuff, you want to print a whole list of stuff, and it's a little tedious to say print this, print that, print the other. But in terms of the language, there aren't multiple prints. There are single prints that you do repeatedly. So, okay, no big difference. You could certainly program the bottom if you absolutely had to, although it's not convenient. The problem comes when you get to unparsing. If you have a print node, and let pn be print node, it has one tree that's an expression. So that would be something like an intlet node for one. And then a print node for two. And then the null node to represent factors, no more things to be printed. Well, the unparsing has a problem that the unparsing is kind of tempted to try to unparse in the bottom form rather than the top form. It says print, okay, how do I do a print node? I write print paren, then print the value of this expression, and then colon semicolon. And that works beautifully if you have one item in the list. But if you have two items in the list, you're tempted to print the second form rather than the first. So the question is, what's a workaround on this? It's not even really a workaround. It's that unlike a lot of other situations, the way we print the second element in the print list is different than the first. Because the first element has to have the print paren, the second element has to have a comma. And a way to do that is, and there was some mention of this in the Piazza dialogues, if you follow those, is that there's no reason when you're doing an unparsing for a print node that the unparser has to call just itself or other unparsers. It can call other routines that are similar to unparsers but have a little extra information. And the extra information in this case is that I'm in the middle of a print list rather than in the leftmost element. So you could, for example, create a special little method. After all, that's programming. You do that all the time. If you need a little bit of code to do something, you put it into a method, a function, a subprogram, whatever you call it, and use it as needed. That's what people do when they have to do a sort or have to do something that gets the third element of a list or whatever. They write a little method to do it. Well, the method here would say, take this print node, and that's not on our end, that's a PN. I guess I've been around medical people too often. So it's a PN, print node, and says print this node as an interior node rather than an initial node. And all that means is in this particular case, you print a two, and then you recursively call the same routine that says I'm an interior node until you see that the right child is null. How do you check if something is null? Remember, we have this cool little method called isNull. Anytime you have a node, you say, are you null or not? I don't care which variety. There's many varieties. You simply ask them. And it's required to tell the truth. It's one of these truth teller type things. And you say, are you a null node? And he says, yes or no. If he says no, then you mean you have more elements. You need to continue to print them. When finally you get here, you say, are you null? And he says, yes, I am. And that means you don't call them. You don't really need to. You simply terminate the things by doing the close paren and the semicolon. Now, a number of you have figured that out, and I'm sorry if I stole your thunder, but in some cases, it's a situation where you get so used to doing something in one way, then when it doesn't quite work that way, you get frustrated. And this, by the way, would be a similar thing for a read. Read and the print are simply saying that in this case, a list of reads or a list of prints are semantically equivalent to one read, followed by another, or one print, followed by another, or another. So if you've seen that problem, you've had it, just be aware that it's a known problem. It's not even really a problem. It's simply a way, the fact that uniform formatting doesn't quite always work. This is a case where you need a variation. But adding a new method that prints a slightly different format works fine. And that's a good way. There are other workarounds, too, that you may have come with. But if you've seen that, then you're not alone in discovering it. And if you haven't seen it yet, when you get to doing that part of it, you certainly will. Okay, let's continue on then. Let's make sure this guy's not dead yet. What I was doing, and I just wanted to continue talking a little bit about the various rules you have to enforce, and then we're going to actually get into the code and the stylistic things to enforce the rules. But in a nutshell, what you're going to be doing is doing a walk, a tree walk. In this case, the tree walk will have methods in this class type checking that says, when I visit, in this case, I'm not going to do unparsing, but I may print error messages, and I'm not going to do any information about cross-reference gathering. It's going to do a different sort of analysis, but it's on the same tree. And what it's going to do is say, I'm going to do type checking. What is type checking? It's simply all these rules, that these bulleted rules we have here. And I'll show you in most cases where they go. But each and every one of these will have to be enforced at some point. There'll be some other ancillary rules too, like the fact that identifiers have to be declared. We talked a little bit about that. Use of an undeclared identifier is illegal, etc. So all those will have to be enforced. But basically what will happen is you'll visit a particular node. Let's say it's a while node. And how do you know that? Well, because you're in the type checking method associated with while nodes. If you look inside the class, there are visit methods for each and every kind of node you have. And in a few cases, you don't have to do anything at all. There's no type checking required. What's an example of that? Well, an integer literal. You don't have to type check an integer literal because the way it works out is that when the actual tree is built in the modified AST class I've given you, we set the type and kind. That's because integer literals are so trivial, they can't be wrong once they get past the scanner. If they get past the scanner, you know they're valid digits, maybe with a twiddle for negatives, and they're a valid number, and presumably if they're too big or too small, you've printed a warning message and given maxint or minint. So you know it's an integer, and you know it's a literal, but a literal is, of course, just a constant. It simply means you can't change a constant. It's illegal in almost every programming language I know to say 1 equals 2. In this case, remember, this is not the equal. It's not saying, are you comparing? Is this true or false? That's saying actually assign 2 to 1. We say, well, duh, anybody knows that. Well, it turned out it's not true. In the very earliest versions of Fortran, which is probably the first really successful programming languages, goes all the way back to the 50s. Most of you weren't born then. I was just barely born then. But programming languages go back. Actually, in Fortran, there was a backdoor way of changing constants. And what was really bad about that, and this, I must admit, I was a naughty boy. I was an undergraduate and one of these undergraduates who thought he was smarter than everybody else in the world. And you, of course, you've never met any of those guys before, but I was one of them. And it turned out there'd be a way of changing the value of a constant. But what the compiler did to save space is pooled constants so that repeated uses shared one memory location. So what would happen is there'd be a memory location that would hold the value 1. And wherever you print out the 1, it would whenever you talk about a 1, it would talk about the same memory location. So if I had print 1, the 1 would be implemented by having a pointer to a memory location that was initialized to the value 1. Well, so what? Well, what would happen is if you did the backdoor way of assigning it, this thing wouldn't work, but there was a backdoor way of doing it where I could change 1 to 2. I'd change not just that 1, but all 1s in the entire program. So I'd take a little subroutine that had only one print statement in a whole program, and I'd walk up to the consultant and say, Kali, something's wrong. I'm running this program and it says print 2 and 1, I'm sorry, print 1 and 2 is popping out. And boy, I had these guys calling IBM and searching back and forth. And I don't know if they ever figured out quite what I was doing. But after a while, I decided it was just too much, you know, like torture or something. It was, you know, like kicking a guy when he was down or whatever. But so it's illegal to do this. And that's one of the evolutionary paths of programming languages, is to stop people from doing foolish things, either because they didn't know what they were doing, or like me, they were a little too smart for their own good and wanted to show off that to the higher ups. So what would happen in this particular case, when you have an integer literal, that really doesn't need to be type checked because it's so simple it can't possibly be wrong. If it got past the scanner, as I said, it's got to be correct. Its type is integer, its value, its kind is constant. Because literal simply means constant, it means thou shalt not change it. And in modern languages, this backdoor trick is long since gone. It should never have been in there, it was an oversight, but in the early days, people didn't fully understand what they were doing. That's where some of that if-then-else stuff that you've been playing with came into place. People saw if-then was cool. Hey, if if-then is cool, if-then-else is cooler still. And we can have the two versions, and you've seen the history of how they sort of overlap, and one can be confused with the other. So at any rate, let's continue on. Let me find my sheet. Huh? Here it is. And just as time ran out on last session, we were talking about, when I'm on page 4, and we were talking about reason rights. And here's a case where many languages have all sorts of odd rules about reading and writing, what can be read and what can be written. And what happens is Java's done, I think, a really nice little idea, and you perhaps used it and perhaps you use it more in future. Namely, almost anything you can declare is a class object, and class objects can always have a method called toString. And whenever you have to convert something to a string, for printing, for example, it calls the method. That means you have control over a complex object of how it's printed out. And that's something which you should really use when you're developing our program in class or other programs if you're in the Java language, in that it's a really cool way to say, okay, I've got this complex thing, what's in it? Well, normally the way you find out is you print, but you don't have to necessarily put a lot of print statements in as you're debugging. You can simply say, print out this thing and have a comprehensive toString that shows all the contents to whatever detail is needed. So I think it's a very handy sort of thing. In our particular language, we have a limited number of things that can be written. There are certain things that can't be written, like an array of integers can't be written as such. Why? Well, if you really want it, you can simply write a loop and run through the loop and print individual elements as individual integers, and that certainly can be printed. So it's a matter of complexity from the compiler writer versus generosity to the user. And there's always this design of, should we make the language more complex or easier? Does that burden the user too much, or does it burden the compiler writer and the software maintainer too much? So this is the middle of the page, and the rule in our language is that int, bool, and char values can be printed. Those are the basics. Of course, you have to print them, if only that when you're developing a program, you may want to debug or you want to have an answer printed. You can also print out character arrays. That's so that you can develop non-constant messages. You can say error and then detail what it is. And string literals so that you can print things like titles and so on. So those are the only things that it can be printed. Only integer and character values can be read. Notice that means strings may not be read. That's one of the reasons why I decided strings shouldn't be a type. Strings are constant values that are really a conglomeration of characters. Characters can be read and written. Strings can be written, but they cannot be read. What can happen is you can go ahead and read characters into an array and print an array. So you get that effect via a backdoor. But that's the rule in this language. And again, I'm balancing comprehensiveness that I could do realistic programs versus the more features I put in, the harder work it is for you later in the semester to finish off the language. So we have to balance it to something that's powerful, but not so comprehensive that it can't possibly be done in a semester. Going on to assignment, the types of an assignment's left and right-hand sides must be identical. Entire arrays can be assigned. And remember, we were talking last time, just as class let out, about the fact that in Java, array assignment may not work the way you want it. In our language, array assignment probably works the way you think it should. But again, I'm getting into your head, and that's something which you can't always tell about what you do. But let me explain the difference. In many languages, when you assign a complex data object, like, say, an array, so I have an array A sub 10, and array B sub 10. And I say A gets B. What that means is copy all the elements of element B into A. It's as if you had a loop shooting from 1 to 10 or 0 to 9, depending on what your indexing preferences are, and copied individual elements. But it turns out, and in fact, that is the way it works in our language. When you assign an array in our language, you copy each and every element from the source array to the target array, probably doing some kind of loop or something in terms of the implementation. In Java, however, remember that arrays are objects. And when you talk about the name of an object, you're really talking about a reference to the actual object. So if I have B, and then later do the assignment A, a la this guy, I have two references to the same object. And that means that it's the case, and you may be surprised by this and disappointed. Certainly, I think there are some errors that pop up with people using arrays as if they were in old-style languages and not the style Java does, that if I say A sub 1 gets 2, that automatically implies that B sub 1 is also equal to 2. in the comparison sense, because they're the same object. If I change one component, I change the other. It's just like you having two alternative names. If you're a performer, you have your real name and you have your stage name. And presumably, you know, one and the other, they're interchangeable. I did not do that largely because we do not have a full object language in CSX. CSX uses objects, but to a more limited extent. And therefore, when we do arrays, we treat them like the old style, that an array is a conglomeration of data, and just like assigning a single scalar changes the variable, assigning an entire array changes each corresponding component position by position. That's the way it works. You may believe that's the correct way of doing it. You may not. It turns out that in Java, you can get the other way of doing it, where you get an entirely different object. But what you have to do is use a method called clone. And I've seen too many sci-fi movies, I guess, in this area particularly. You know, is there any clone room or anything, you know, where if they're short of new employees, they just clone a few and they come marching out? That's next year's situation. If we don't hire enough good people, we'll start cloning them. So what you can do is you can actually call a method called clone, which will physically create a second object identical to the first object component-wise, and then you assign the clone to the new variable. It's something you have to know to do. It's not something that happens automatically. But again, this is a sort of a design decision in languages. And it's a situation you say, well, why in the world do they do it this way? It looks like this thing of doing copying references is El Cheapo. And it is. And in fact, it's given a name. It's called shallow copy. Is there one or two L's in? So let's hope there's only one. So a shallow copy says that I'm just copying the least amount of information necessary, the references. There's also something called deep copy. And I know there's a room here called deep, because I know the situation you're hearing about that. And deep copy means that you go down and you copy the entire structure. But remember, that can be potentially expensive. You created a very complex structure in your parser, namely the AST for an entire program. The AST is a big conglomeration of a root node and children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And if you do an assignment of one AST reference to another, do you want a complete copy or do you just want to share a reference? It's not always clear, and that's one of the ambiguities in programming languages. What does assignment mean? Does it mean sharing access? If you're primarily reading the object, it makes sense. And in fact, you all took Jeff's course last semester, and you learned particularly about how when you have databases, if databases are meant to be largely shared, and when am I talking to you folks about databases, but it's a situation, there's always this issue about how much of a database do you lock so that it's protected versus do you lock everything? Well, then it really serializes access. If you don't lock anything, you can get all sorts of races and things like that. You learned about that from Jeff. You presumably knew it anyway, because a lot of what you do revolves around intricate databases. But it's the same sort of thing, surprisingly, or perhaps not, in data structures. In data structures in general, do you want to pay the price and time and memory to make a complete copy of a potentially very large structure? In fact, it can even be worse than that. Another thing that you can typically do, and maybe this is something that when you took CS367, when you worried about data structures, you can have circular data structures. Something like that. Those are perfectly reasonable, and again, you have circular data structures when you might want to have some sort of round-robin policy where everybody gets his or her turn, and then the next guy in queue is served, but nobody gets starved out. Nobody gets more service than anybody else. If you have a data structure like this and you're trying to do deep copy, you may get yourself into a problem of having an infinite copy loop, and that's been known to happen. So complex data structures, if you do a deep copy, are problematic. If I do a shallow copy, it doesn't matter. I just have lots of pointers into one particular aspect of the structure. So there are issues on both sides. And what does this have to do with our project? Only a little bit in that, in designing a language, and we really are, we're going to own the language. One of the things I've told you is you should feel free to think about doing changes. Maybe you have your own preferences about what ought to be in a language, how it ought to be done, etc. And when these decisions are made, they need to be thought through, and sometimes a simple decision like how an array is assigned is not nearly as simple as you might imagine. So let's see, we were talking about array assignments. Okay, next point is the size of an array parameter is not known at compile time. An array parameter is something that's passed to a subprogram. You pass an array, but its size is not known at compile time. The size of an array in most modern languages, and this is pretty well accepted now, is part of the data. In the old days, the size of an array was part of its type. So an array of 10 was a different type than an array of 20. Turns out that didn't work out very well if you want to have something like a sort. Do you want to have a sort, one sort that sorts just 10 objects, another one that sorts 25 objects, another one that sorts 33 and a third objects? Answer is probably not. So the trend has been that the size of an array is part of its data, and you simply have an array whose size I will know when I want to by checking. There's usually some sort of method that says, give me its length. So you say array.len or length or whatever they call it, and you can check that way. So in this particular case, the size of an array parameter is not known compile time, but there is a rule that says when I assign one array to another, they have to be the same size. If I didn't have that, I'd either worry about having some elements not filled or some elements lost. So if I assign an array to another at runtime, they have to be the same size. Sometimes I can check that at compile time by just looking at the declaration. Hey, array A, how many elements do you have? Hey, array B, how many elements do you have? That's part of its type information. When you collect the type information from an array, you're going to say it's an array, its component type is, say, integer, and here's its size. When arrays are declared, their size is always known. But it's something there, and you say, when I do the assignment, it better be the case that A and B have the same size. But if one or the other are array parameters, you won't know that till runtime. Don't worry about that in type checking. All that means is I'm going to defer it at runtime. When I actually do the assignment, I'll say, are your lengths the same? If they are, fine and dandy. If they're not, I throw an error saying you're trying to do something illegal, sort of along the same flavor as following a null reference or trying to divide by zero. There's certain things that are not checked until runtime, but if they happen at runtime, they'll be runtime errors, presumably severe enough to terminate execution. So the size of an array parameter is not known until runtime, and in that particular case, you have to check at runtime. The types of parameters have to be the same. That's well known. There's no conversion unless you do explicit typecasting. Arrays are passed as reference parameters. That's again, something that will be a code generation issue, but something you need to know. The reason they're passed as reference parameters is essentially we implement them in Java, and in Java, remember, an array is a reference to an object. So when you pass a parameter, you're just passing a reference to the object. And that's similar in C, and I think probably in C# too, and C++. So that's not an unusual way of doing things. Assignments to constant identifiers is illegal. You may not do it. That means that something that looks like a valid assignment, like A gets 1, may be illegal. That's something you'll have to check for. Why? Well, maybe that when you look at the kind of A, it says I am a constant. How do you do that? Well, remember we have a declaration of something const 10 equals 10, for example. And this is a way of going ahead and giving a name to a numeric value and therefore making something somewhat more readable. But once something is defined as a constant, it may not be changed. You can't even change it by passing it as a parameter and having the parameter go ahead and try to assign to it. That's simply not going to be allowed in that particular case. Let's see. There are two kinds of subprograms. There are something called procedures, which are methods that return void. Void means I don't return a value per se, I'm called for my side effects. For example, sort method is oftentimes void because all it does is rearrange the elements in the array. It doesn't give you any extra return information. So it's called for the side effect of reordering the elements in an array. So in that case, if you happen to have something that's a procedure, it has to be declared of type void, and it has to be called at the statement level. That is, if something returns void, you cannot use it in an expression. That sort of makes sense, because if you are an expression, you're going to want to have a value, and that value has to be manipulated, but void is the non-value. So procedures, and you always know a procedure because its declared return type is void, which means nothing. That can only be called as a statement at the statement level. Functions are the exact opposite. They're methods that do return a value. The type is declared in the declaration. So you say, I'm an integer function, or I'm a character valued function, or I'm a Boolean valued function. Functions can only be called in expressions, maybe an assignment, maybe in the computation of a value. The type of the function is the type that it returns, and the expected result will be call the function, get a value, and then use that value in computation of the expression. There are two kinds of returns, correspondingly. There's a return that returns an expression and a return that doesn't. That is, you have return semicolon versus return one. Now, let me give you a little heads up on this, because this can be sort of interesting. If you're going ahead and doing type checking for returns, you're going to say, okay, if I'm inside a void-valued method, that means I use return of the first form without a return parameter. If I'm inside of a function, that is something whose return type is non-void, I use something of the second sort. But there's only, if you look at it, there's only one return node in the AST. And what it does is it has a subfield, a subtree, that's an expression option. It means it may be there or may not be there. So here's where you can use that is null again. But we've got a more interesting problem, and something you may not have thought about, but it turns out trees are very asymmetric in terms of their traversal. It's easy to get to children and grandchildren. Remember, you have that dot notation. If I have the name of a class, I can say class.field or class.field.field and go down a tree. But how do I go up a tree? In fact, there's an old saying about being up a tree, and that's not a good thing. Well, why would you want to go up a tree? Can anybody guess how I going up a tree would be an issue, a return of these two forms? Yeah, you got to know what function you're in, and that guy's the guy's there. You're sitting under him, but maybe many levels. So a little trick we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and actually have a particular a shared variable that's available to the type checker and later to the code generator that's called current method. And the thing to remember in our language, along with most other object-oriented languages, virtually all code is inside of a method. The only thing that's not inside of a method are fields. And fields are simply a declaration, possibly with an initializing expression. So what current method will be, and what will happen is if you're not inside of a method, current method will be null. That's the place where using null is okay. But normally, it'll be a pointer up the tree to the method that you're currently in. So anytime you want to know something about the method you're currently in, for example, in this case, I hit a return, and the guy says, return semicolon. And I say, I got to type check that. If this guy's inside of a function, that's illegal, this form, the one I've just circled, because you got to return a value. Vice versa, if it's a situation I say return one in a void-valued function, what does that mean? I can't. A void-valued function does not return. There's something wrong. Probably the body and the type declaration are mismatched and somebody's wrong and something's got to be fixed. So what you can do is you can go up the current method to say, okay, here's the method I'm currently in. And that's because, again, trees are asymmetric. It's easy to walk down, but it's not clear how you work up. You can have back pointers and all that, but that would make your tree much more complex and you only use them very rarely. So a little trick which you'll need to do both in project 4 and 5 is sometimes you have to go and look at what method am I in, and a way to do that is have this particular reference called current method. When will that be set? Well, when it's first created, it's null. When I get around to type checking an entire method, I'll say, hey, I'm now in method M or method P or method Q, and I'll set this pointer. Whenever I leave that method, I can clear it and go to the next method. But normally, almost all the code in a Java class or in our particular CSX is going to be inside of a method or a number of methods, but one or the other. And therefore, almost all the time when you're type checking, saying what method am I in makes sense. And when it doesn't make sense, it'll simply be null, and it'll say, well, that's the case where you're not in a method. So that's a little heads up, because some of this type checking is easy. Just go down and look at your children and say, what's your types? Are they valid or invalid? But occasionally, you have to go up the tree. And in that case, having something like this, saying there's a way to get at the current method. In this case, I simply use a reference. You can imagine having a method or something. That's a bit more complex. So something that can essentially find out what the method is that controls you. You know, your great, 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 great something is method so-and-so. And I guess you could go to Ancestry.com or something and they would help you out if it's free trial weekend, but I don't know. Does anybody belong to Ancestry.com? How much do they charge? I've always, you know, they show all these cool things. You know, you always have this great parent. You know, your great, great, great grandfather came on the Mayflower or something like that. And okay, yeah, enough that it makes you think. Yeah, that's what I think. Situation there. And most cases, knowing my relatives, they probably came in a prison barge or something. They probably got sent to Australia, and the Australians wouldn't have them. They sent them back to the West Coast, and they ended up somehow in Madison, Wisconsin. So anyway, that's something about returns. And so this is the point there. And also, I'm getting a little ahead of yourself, but there's a rule that says, you have to have a return in every program. That's really not quite enough in most languages. So what we're doing is saying is we're going to put a return in at the end of any program so you don't have to explicitly check for it. That's not an unblemished blessing because you have a function. If there's an implicit return, you may have to end up returning something unspecified. That is, if you have a function that should do a return of something and you terminate execution by going to the very bottom of a program without hitting an explicit return. In that particular case, this bottom bullet, the very last one on page 2, will apply. And what will happen is if it's a function, it'll return some preferred initial value. In particular, if it's a character, it'll be the null character. If it's an integer, it'll be 0. And if it's a Boolean, it'll be false. As close to 0 as you can get, just as an arbitrary but consistent return value. The reason for that is if we didn't do that, you'd have to do a more complex analysis and say, hey, here's a function. Is there any way I can get out of this function without doing a return? And particularly, you know, or either way, you could check at the bottom and say, is there a return sitting at the bottom? But that may never be reachable. So if you think about it, for functions, you have all these various control paths. It may be the case that the function can never reach the very bottom of a program and have this implicit return. But you can't tell very easily one way or the other. So we're giving you sort of a way out. We're saying we're always going to put a return there. If you never use it, fine and dandy. If it's a function, it'll be return of a specified null value. And again, typically 0 or something close to 0. The 0 character, you know, the character with the 0 representation. Or false, which is represented by 0. Or 0, which is a valid integer. See, we play all kinds of little tricks, and you think you do it only with your software. We do it in languages and compilers, too. Okay. There exists typecasting. Oh, yeah, that's another something that came up there in terms of your current project and future projects. Sometimes when you want to pass something to a particular method, you run into a problem in our language that we have something option. We might have statement option or expression option or declaration option, something like that. And the situation is, if you want to call something and you're not sure which type it is, remember when you create a method, for example, for unparsing, I have to say, here's the particular type. One thing you can do if you know what its type is, and typically if you have an option, you can say, are you null? If you're not null, then you're not an expert option, you're an expert. You're not a statement option, you're a statement. So you can check and say, are you null? If you're not null, then the option is not taken. And what you can do is typecasting in Java, just as you do typecasting in CSX. That means if I have some particular reference P, and I want this to be a print node, for example. You can typecast something by putting a type in parentheses ahead of the thing and say, please go ahead and convert this to the type in question. If it can be done, it will be done. If it can't be done, you'll get a runtime termination. Say, hey, you tried to cast something that doesn't work. That's a termination error. But in some situations, if you have something where it wants an exact type, you may have to typecast to force it to be that type. And if you look very carefully, I did that, for example, when I first start in P2 or P3 or P4, and I would say, I want you to start at the root of the tree. I always know that root of the tree is either a light node or a class node. And if you notice, I went ahead and cast the thing saying, yeah, you have a reference to some kind of AST node, but I know better than that. I know depending on which version it is, it's either the CSX light node or it's the class node. Okay. Okay, that's a good place to take a break. We're almost done with these thou shalts and thou shalt nots. And then we'll actually get on to the lecture, and I'll show you how to start implementing some of this stuff. So it's 6:30. We got a break for about 15 minutes, and see you about quarter of.